Bienvenidos a un nuevo episodio del podcast de K-Fan, un espacio en el que aprender de emprendedores que han creado, escalado y a veces vendido empresas tecnológicas.
Urbanitae es una nueva plataforma de inversión inmobiliaria que te permite invertir a lo grande con cantidades pequeñas. Uniendo a muchos inversores, logramos juntar el capital suficiente para aprovechar las mejores oportunidades del sector. Olvídate de complicaciones. Con Urbanitae ya puedes invertir en el sector inmobiliario como lo hacen los profesionales.
Good morning, everyone. I'm here with Isabel. How are you, Isabel?
Hi, Jaime. I'm great. And you?
I'm good. Looking forward to this because this is a different topic than we usually cover. So since you know our guest better than I do, Isabel, who are we talking to today and what are we going to talk about?
Yeah, sure. So with us today, we have a very special guest, Kai, and he is the co-founder and CEO at Moltus. And we're bringing Kai here today because we've been... At K-Fund lately, we've been looking a lot into opportunities around food tech and agri-tech in specific companies that are addressing scaling production for food for our growing population. And basically, Moltus is a company that is trying to do exactly that and targeting the current bottlenecks in the cultivated meat industry. And I think, Kai, please feel free and introduce yourself.
Absolutely. Thank you very much and really great to be here. So I'm Kai. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Moltus. I have a background in bioengineering and studied at Imperial College here in the UK. And I met my co-founders in 2019 and really wanted to see how we can apply the tools in engineering and data science to biology, and in particular to create solutions in climate change. Because at the time, there were protests around London that were pretty much shutting down the city in response to climate change. And I felt very strongly that we have a duty now to create technical solutions to this global problem. And the opportunity I saw was in a new emerging field called cultivated meat. So this is a new way of producing real meat without the need to kill tens of billions of animals every year. And so there are about 150 companies around the world now that are producing meat as we know it by growing now the muscle and fat tissues, a bit like we brew beer, as a far more efficient and resource efficient way of producing meat without the environmental impact that industrial farming has. Whilst this industry has so much promise and technically is quite amazing, the big challenges still are in cost and getting to scale. And so as an engineer, as a bioengineer, I really wanted to work on bottlenecks that would allow not just me, but potentially hundreds of companies around the world to make cultivated meat a reality and accelerate the adoption of cultivated meat, affordable cultivated meat at scale. And so we work on enabling technology that will allow companies to scale production affordably and profitably. And more specifically, we design the feedstock that is fed to these cells to grow quickly and functionally. So we design different combinations of ingredients that will help cow muscle cells grow as muscle cells or pig fat cells grow as fat cells, all the while whilst driving down the cost of manufacturing to make these products a reality.
That's amazing. One question, Kai. Did you build a company out of school, or did you work on something else before this, or did you jump straight to it?
So this grew out of a project. So at the time, I met my co-founders, our CTO, Kevin. He has a background in data science. He really came to Imperial to apply that to biology and found his niche within systems biology and modeling. Our other co-founder, Reka, she has a background in synthetic biology and regenerative medicine. So we were all quite technical founders coming into this, initially very excited about how tools in engineering biology could be used to create new practical solutions in the real world. We started as a project working on some precision fermentation, thinking about protein engineering, thinking about growth, the engineering challenge of growth media, kind of formulation optimization. And after about a year of jumping around a few labs at Imperial and a few competitions here and there, just as the pandemic was hitting, we decided really that we wanted to jump in and take this on full time and really embrace the opportunity in front of us to create a real difference around the world. And so we joined an accelerator program called IndieBio. It's one of the largest, more prominent life science accelerator programs in the world. They used to have a program here in London called Rebel Bio that we were well aware of. And so we're very inspired by the teams that had been going through that. And just as the pandemic hit, that Rebel Bio program transferred to New York. In the end, we stayed here in London, obviously, with the pandemic, and were able to build out our base here in West London whilst going through the program to bring our first product to market.
And just a question there. Why did you guys decide to specifically choose this problem to solve? Like, what was it? Was it like a group project, or was it passion? Was it driven by what exactly?
So we got together within a society. So we were passionate, I think, mostly about the tools that were available in synthetic biology and engineering biology, and the specific engineering challenge in growth media. So as we were looking at cultivated meat, we were asking ourselves, well, you know, if this industry and technology is so amazing, why do we not see any products on the market today? The very first cultivated meat burger was announced about 10 years ago in London by a Dutch professor called Professor Mark Post. He now has a company called Moser Meat, which is doing incredibly well. But 5 years after that, in 2019, we were still asking, well, you know, that first burger cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to produce. Where are we today on that cost curve? And so in really digging into the manufacturing process, speaking to companies, reading the literature, it became incredibly apparent that the cost and design, the optimization of growth media, really is an existential challenge for every company that is holding back this whole industry from getting products to market. And actually, as we kind of dug deeper into that, we realized that every stage of a company's development, they need different solutions, but solutions relating to growth media in order to move them forward. And so that was very inspiring to us to see that we could help companies get started by allowing them to move away from some of the animal-derived components that they might traditionally be working with in the background in biomedical research. Then as they're thinking about getting products to market, the growth media really drives a lot of the consideration on manufacturing costs and productivity, also has ties to the regulatory considerations. And then ultimately, as this industry starts to mature, it's the growth media that's going to drive some of the sustainability considerations. And so as a constant input to the manufacturing process alongside electricity, really careful considerations required on the supply chain to make this process better for the world. And so we saw this as core, as central to the whole industry, and wanted to build technology that would allow companies around the world to make cultivated meat a more affordable and accessible choice.
I'm just wondering, because I'm not sure if all of the listeners actually know what growth media is and how does the supply chain actually look like for the lab-grown industry. So can you just give a quick explanation, maybe like for people that are not from the industry, like what does this actually mean and where do you guys sit within the production?
Absolutely. Yeah. So growth media, you can think of, it's a bit like the soil that you might use to grow vegetables. It provides all the nutrients for, in this case, animal muscle and fat tissues to grow. And so it's a combination of, as you might expect, different sugars, lipids, amino acids, vitamins, minerals, but also very specific signaling proteins that guide, in essence, cell behavior. They tell a cell to grow as a muscle cell, or they tell a cell to grow as a fat cell. And this combination of different signals are really important to create the right growth environment for cells, but also guide some of the behavior towards better tasting or healthier products ultimately. And so you can control some sensory and nutritional elements of the end products by designing this growth stimulus with the growth media. And so traditionally for about 60 years now in biomedical research, we've been growing cells to create new therapies and solutions in cancer biology and vaccine manufacturing and antibody production. And broadly, those industries are reliant on gaining that signaling stimulus from something called fetal bovine serum, which is as horrible as it might initially sound, essentially from the livestock industry. Yes, that actually is. From the livestock industry, as and when cows happen to be pregnant, those cows are often taken and you extract fetal blood and spin it down, remove the red blood cells, and that serum that remains contains an incredibly rich cocktail of nutrients to help cells grow very quickly. And so that is almost universally used in biomedical research to grow cells, and companies are reliant on that often at the very early stages in cultivated meat too. And so we thought, you know, this really doesn't align with some of the ethical and environmental considerations and principles of cultivated meat. But two, as a byproduct of the animal industry, we're really constrained by the ability to scale and the expensive nature of this byproduct. And so 60 years later, we now have the tools in very high throughput screening and lab automation to collect high quality data and sufficient data to then apply tools in AI and machine learning to actually start building an understanding about how we can replace something very complex like fetal bovine serum with building blocks of growth media, those different nutrients that I talked about. And so that's really our approach there. Broadly, the supply chain, then alongside things like growth media, you also need cells. So there are companies now working on finding the best types of cells to grow, and you want cells that grow quickly. You also want cells that are functional from a sensory perspective or a nutritional perspective. And so selecting the right kind of cell is quite important. Alongside that, then you have companies working on scaffolding technology, which really creates structure in these end products. And perhaps one of the benefits of plant-based meat products is that truly you can grow muscle and fat tissues that have 3D structural properties. So you can get closer to your steak or your fillet than you perhaps might be able to do in plant-based meat or traditional plant-based meat products, at least. And then finally, the third part of the kind of technical inputs to cultivated meat are bioreactors. And these are these big metal tanks that you might traditionally know as being used in the brewing industry that grow yeast. Instead of growing yeast in this sense, we're growing animal cells. And there are companies that are trying to innovate in the design of these bioreactors to help the cells grow better and improve efficiencies in manufacturing.
Mm. Amazing.
I mean, I can jump into another question, but Jaime, please interrupt me if
No, go for it. Go for it, Isabel. Go for it.
And this was something that actually last time we spoke, Kai, you explained it to me, and it was something that really stuck to me, which is if fetal bovine serum has been around for years, why hasn't it been optimized up until now in terms of cost, in terms of scalability, in terms of everything, its application? Like, why is it only now that the food industry is the one that's trying to crack this, and the incentives have not been there yet?
There are probably three core reasons for the reason for fetal bovine serum still being used quite universally 60 years later. Number one is exactly the incentives you talked about. So the biomedical research industry and the biopharma industry, because of all the costs that go into doing research and getting a new therapy to market, oftentimes when things work, you don't want to tweak them too much. So fetal bovine serum grows cells and it's expensive, yes, but it works. And so biopharmaceutical companies are happy to pay that premium and pass on that cost to the end consumer, and therefore use a pretty inefficient and expensive product to produce their products. Secondly is on the incentives now around cultivated meat. So we're now in a completely different industry with completely different constraints and requirements. For example, we need growth media that's producing orders of magnitude higher quantities, more quantities than is used in the biopharmaceutical industry. And as FBS is a byproduct, it just simply cannot scale to the extent that is required to displace industrial farming at scale. Number two then is price. We're now concerned about price and we need to be competitive with conventional products on the market. FBS, or fetal bovine serum, can cost hundreds of dollars per liter. And you're using maybe 10, 20, 50 liters per kilogram of production. That does not make a product that's competitive and commercially viable. And so
one question on that, Kai, why is it so expensive? Is it like a supply issue, hard to obtain, or what is the supply? What is the issue then?
Yeah, a combination of supply issues. So as a byproduct, you're reliant on the supply and demand of cows, and that fluctuates. Oh. And so there's incredible volatility in the availability of things like fetal bovine serum. The production is fairly... the extraction process is fairly extensive and manual, and then you have to ship products around the world. There are only certain countries that produce fetal bovine serum. For example, you won't get any fetal bovine serum from the UK, and that's because there's a risk of viral contamination. And 20 years ago, we had mad cow disease outbreak, and so the risk there is too high. And so you only really get fetal bovine serum from South America, Australia.
I don't recommend you to watch a video on it, but if you watch a video on it, you'll understand exactly why it's so expensive. It is pretty horrible process.
I was Googling around. I didn't get to the video part, but I can imagine. Yeah, I'll leave it for later.
Yeah. Don't do it after eating food, that's for sure. It's very expensive, and the incentive now in cultivated meat are to drop the price. And then the third key reason why now we are able to actually find an alternative is because of the tools we have available in collecting and distilling a large amount of data. If you just think about the optimization challenge at hand here, you're trying to control very complex cell biology to have cells grow in a certain way and taste in a certain way. You're then trying to do that by altering a combination of 50, maybe 100 ingredients that can be at any concentration range. That essentially creates an infinite solution space. Even if you chose 10 different concentrations, that'd be 10 to the 100 possible formulations that you might want to test. And each time you want to test that, you have to grow cells for 2-3 weeks at a time to collect that data. And so it's incredibly laborious to even collect data in the first place. And generally, biology is a pretty manual process. And so you're maybe collecting two data points, data points every 2 or 3 days on how the cells are growing. You're doing that using manual processes. And so the data you collect is perhaps actually not very high quality in the first place to use some of the capabilities now in machine learning to truly grapple that data and use that data to navigate this solution space efficiently. And so at Malthus, we're using such tools, and it's only in the past few years where the capabilities in data science and lab automation have been enough to actually generate sufficient amount of data, sufficient amount of high quality data, and then use tools in AI and machine learning to use that data to find the right replacements for fetal bovine serum. And that means we're screening tens, if not hundreds of thousands of formulations to get to the right endpoint, the right combination of ingredients that can grow cells properly. The added challenge perhaps in cultivated meat now is that on its own is a very difficult challenge. And there's a reason why, even these big growth media companies haven't truly been able to replace fetal bovine serum, even if they tried in the past 60 years. The added challenge in cultivated meat is that the ingredients and cells you're using are also very new. And so we're having to reinvent a whole new supply chain to get the cost of inputs low enough and at the quality and manufacturing standards that are compliant with food. That means you're adding complexity to the problem because you have ingredients that interact with each other. You have ingredients that maybe have multiple effects on how the cells are behaving. And your growing cells have never really been studied to a great extent in biomedical research. And so there isn't this fundamental understanding of how you might build a formulation from the bottom up. And so then at its core, growth media is a data challenge. And at Multis, we've built the capabilities to solve that data challenge. And that means investing very heavily in lab automation, in machine learning, and the ability to turn biology into an engineering discipline.
That was going to be my next question, which was, so what are some of the efforts that, like, what is the key success factor that makes a company crack this? And what are the main players out there? And how do you feel that you guys are doing it differently?
So, yeah, maybe I can talk through some of the traditional approaches and perhaps why they aren't good enough. So there's a few kind of, I guess, evolutions of approaches that have been taken generally to challenges like growth media. First of all, there's a called OFAT, or one factor at a time. That's essentially taking one ingredient, testing at several different concentrations, finding the best concentration there, and then moving on to your next ingredient. That one takes an incredibly long amount of time going one ingredient by one ingredient, but two is reliant on the assumption that the ingredients have an independent effect on cell growth, and the effect on cell growth is very clear. That clearly is not the case in cultivated meat. And so you have maybe now more statistical approaches to designing growth media, approaches like design of experiments, where you think about a limited set of experiments that allow you to infer relationships between ingredients and outcomes. This generally has an upper limit of 10, maybe 20 ingredients, and again, breaks down when you have large amounts of interactions between the set of input ingredients you have. And so this has been the approach for the past few decades to design growth media. And it's why maybe some replacements to FBS that have been developed are simple. You have products that you're trying to strip down FBS to its minimal components to have cells essentially just surviving. That is in no way to boost performance and think about how having rapid and functional cell growth can really improve product performance and improve unit economics. So new approaches now in machine learning actually allow us to build off and accumulate knowledge around how cells behave differently when they're grown in different growth media formulations. And this is really important when you're trying to not only work with a very high number of complex ingredients, but also when you're trying to grow cells for multiple different objectives. Because in cultivated meat, we need cells to grow quickly. We also need cells to grow in inexpensive growth media. We might want cells to have certain functionality so that they can be used in as a good fat replacement for taste, a good fat replacement for health, a good muscle, good muscle structure, or even growing skin cells to make leather replacements. And so there are multiple objectives that you might have for cell behavior, and you're using tens, if not hundreds, of ingredients as your inputs. And that creates an optimization challenge that is only really tractable by using tools in AI and machine learning. And to do that, you need sufficient data and you need high quality data. And really not many companies are equipped to do both of those.
One question, Kai. I mean, as I said before, I'm not the biggest expert on the field, and I don't much about it, which I think makes it even more interesting. So what's actually the breakthrough that allows for this? Because you talk about a lot about data, about machine learning. So is it like new developments in algorithms and stuff like that allow for this to happen now? I mean, I'm sure there's other circumstances, but from a technology point of view, is that the core, like data availability that you can process with new machine learning, deep learning and AI techniques?
Yeah, it's exactly that. It's the ability to use a large amount of data to guide, I mean, not even necessarily a large amount initially, but use high quality data to guide iterative optimization. And then over time, build this cumulative knowledge around cell growth and behavior. And then that combination with what you can now do in terms of lab automation to collect consistent high quality data, that just hasn't been the case before in biomedical research when you're manually growing cells and taking an image and counting cells by eye. That doesn't create the kind of data that you can use in machine learning. And so it's a combination really of kind of software, hardware, and then what we can do with the biology that becomes really powerful. If you're just doing modeling, pure data approach, then you won't get the kind of outcomes because biology is so complex and it's very context dependent. So you need this marriage of biology and actually running experiments and collecting real life data and machine learning. And that kind of data just hasn't been collected to the extent certainly that we are before, and isn't available, you know, publicly. That's one of our key strengths, really, is our ability to collect the right kind of data and then apply the latest in machine learning to it.
And then you create, sorry, Sabal, just one last one. Yes. And then you create these alternative products to PBS. And then how do you sell this kind of stuff? I mean, what's the go-to-market motion and who buys this kind of stuff?
Yeah, so we're selling to cultivated meat companies. Actually, I guess more broadly, cellular agriculture companies. So those are companies that are growing cells to replace animal-derived products like meat, like dairy, like materials like leather. And so we have a couple of different business models. And again, this is supporting companies at various stages of their growth trajectory. So at the earlier stages, we have these flagship formulations that we've developed that are off the shelf, and we've designed them for major cultivated meat types or to be broad replacements to FBS.
So maybe just to kind of make it more tangible, what does that actually mean in terms of like the amount that is required from fetal bovine serum and the cost in comparison with the Malta solution to produce an X amount of kilos of meat, for example?
Right. Yeah, I can talk about that. So we have products and services that help companies at the different stages of their growth. At the very early stages, companies are trying to really verify core technology and put in place some baseline metrics for that technology. Often you need to do that without relying on fetal bovine serum, because going from a complex serum-based growth media to a serum-free growth media, like something we design, changes a lot about cell behavior. And so we design off-the-shelf replacements, direct one-to-one replacements to fetal bovine serum. We have a product, Prolifrim M, that's been on the market since early 2022. And we've tested this broadly with the majority of companies in the cultivated meat industry to help them, in many cases for the first time, grow their cells without fetal bovine serum. In terms of price point, obviously at these very early stages, we're not benefiting from really any economies of scale here. So we're in the same order of magnitude on price, but really focused on the ability to help companies move away from FBS and really tackle that performance element. We're now, this industry is now at a stage where it's transitioning from R&D into pilot and ultimately into commercial scale manufacturing. So this is where we're opening up our capabilities in growth media optimization, to have our platform for more intelligent formulation design, where companies then are considering unit economics and regulation and their supply chains in the run-up to get products on the market. And so the way we can help companies there is in our own supply chain that we've developed and qualified, both through internal production and with partners, our ability to solve this very difficult optimization problem towards the objectives of creating better products, and then the kind of the back end work that we've done with regulators to have these inputs suitable for getting, you know, these end products through regulatory approval, and then as they, you know, come off the back of the service, then around developing more bespoke formulations, then we have the production capacity. So we're right now building the world's first growth media production facility designed to make food safe growth media for the cultivated meat industry. This will help companies tremendously accelerate their product development roadmap and get products through regulatory approval much quicker, because again, we've put in place all the right quality control, all the right standards to meet those requirements, those very stringent requirements for food safety.
And how do you think that the traditional meat companies are looking into first like the lab-grown meat industry at large, but then specifically growth mediums like yourself?
It's a very good question. And I think I've been very encouraged to see broadly these large meat companies, Cargill, JBS, Tyson, actually investing in cultivated meat and embracing this as a potentially a very disruptive technology to their core business. This is the first time in about 12,000 years that companies have reinvented how we produce meat and for the better. And so all of those major companies, or the majority of those major meat companies, have investments in cultivated meat startups, in some cases having their own internal projects as well. And even there was an acquisition a couple of years ago of a cultivated meat startup for $100 million to internalize some of this work. And so that, I think, is very positive to see these large corporations embracing this new technology and helping these startups with their distribution get products to market and have these products available around the world. There's on the growth media side, there's an input potentially. So, you know, a lot of these big meat companies also play in industries like animal feed. We have a similar role in growth media. And so there's work that we can do with those companies to qualify or even design new feedstocks that are suitable for growing cultivated meat cells instead of cows. And so we can do work there to design new feedstocks and also work with them to manufacture and produce some of these premixes that can be used for cultivated meat specific applications. So we're very much quite collaborative with incumbent companies, but recognize, I guess they recognize that this is potentially incredibly disruptive technology.
So it almost feels like you're in the best position to capture value among all of the players in the ecosystem, because on one hand you can partner with these huge meat incumbents by providing them with a solution and working with them to be able to faster and better develop lab-grown alternatives. And at the same time, you're not competing with these lab-grown meat companies because you are their provider, or you can be their main provider to enable for them to reach cost parity and scalability. So it's, you're like in the very strategic positioning of not really having a real competitor, but a potential collaborator for all the players. But who would you say is the biggest threat for you, like in the next 10 years? Not like a company, I mean like a player in the industry.
A player generally. Yeah, I think our position is very strong. There's probably two sides in which there is competitive pressure, which might have these big companies be more competitive. So there's obviously the animal feed side, which if we displace factory farming, that's a big hit to that business. And I think that can move very quickly once we start hitting some of these tipping points where government support, public support shifts very quickly towards these more sustainable proteins. On the other side is the biopharmaceutical industry, which again is reliant on feedstocks that have been the same ones that have been used for 60 years. Suddenly, you know, we've built an alternative that's orders of magnitude cheaper. It can grow cells better. We've, yes, been playing around in the cultivated meat industry, but that means that the whole life science industry is pretty ripe for disruption. And I should say the cost of growth media in the cultivated meat production process can be up to 80% of manufacturing costs. That surely is not going to change too dramatically. We see in a very well-established industry like the livestock industry, the cost of animal feed sits around 60% of manufacturing costs. And so it's an incredibly important part of the value chain. But if you just look at similar value chains where either you're growing cells or either you're feeding meat products, then what we're creating is potentially quite disruptive.
How much, Kai, I mean, because you mentioned government support, I mean, how much tailwinds are there in this, and how much do you depend on like government and public support? Because on the one hand, I guess that, I mean, I mean, I was going to say all of us, but most of us, there's like a real fight against climate change or in favor of climate change to fix the situation. But I guess that on the other hand, I mean, these traditional livestock groups and companies, they also have powerful incentives for that not to be the case, and lobbies and that kind of stuff. So how relevant is public support for this kind of stuff, for this to be a thing in the next few years?
The governmental support is incredibly important, public support as well. We're seeing generally, obviously, these products really aren't on the market yet. So a lot of these public surveys, etc., will only get more and more accurate as these products come to market. But over time, and you can see this by looking at reports that were done in 2018 and 19 and 20 right up till today, as people become more aware of challenges around climate change, certainly around the price volatility and food security problems in meat, and some of the health and nutritional problems in conventional meat products, people are looking for alternatives. They're looking for more sustainable alternatives. They're looking for more nutritious alternatives. And so public support is increasing in cultivated meat. And the majority, at least in some of the latest reports, very much open to trying and if not regularly buying cultivated meat over conventional meat. Government support also has a really important part to play. Obviously, a lot of the traditional livestock industry in many countries is heavily subsidized. And so all of those negative externalities are not paid for by the consumer. And so that creates a pretty high bar for more sustainable alternatives to be truly competitive. We are seeing, though, a good level of government support. I think there could be a lot more. But in places like Singapore, where the first product is on the market, there's been an incredible amount of government support. They have a 30 by 30 strategy to try and increase their internal food production to 30% by 2030. And that's initiated a large amount of investment in technology that do not require a lot of land or resources to produce, like cultivated.
Also lowered the regulation requirements to allow
exactly,
that.
Exactly, yeah. So to push these products forward, they've created new regulatory frameworks, very collaborative frameworks, to create new standards for assessing new food technologies. And that's meant that Singapore has been the first country to benefit from being able to access cultivated meat and these new products. Similarly, the US has taken a very proactive step in defining new regulatory frameworks, recognizing this as incredibly important and new. And so they need to be and are being very sophisticated in how they assess the safety of cultivated meat so that there's an appropriate level of scrutiny on safety to have these products on the market quickly, but on the market safely. Following the US are places like Israel and South Korea and Japan, which all have made announcements at the government level around specific changes that they're now implementing to support new food technologies, including cultivated meat. On the specific funding side, whilst there are kind of grants, I guess, at the kind of research and innovation side, we benefited from €2.5 million from the European Commission to build out our pilot plant. There's been more specific, larger scale funding into cultivated meat. So the Dutch government committed €60 million in a large project in cultivated meat, a consortium of companies. Similarly, the UK government just a couple of weeks ago announced €12 million to build a cultivated meat manufacturing hub, which again brings together many of the key stakeholders in the UK on the academic and industry side. There's been funding in the US for academic research departments and institutions into cultivated meat. But I think, if you look at this compared to perhaps the support that was put towards the moonshot, which was literally to get people to the moon, this is a very, very tiny amount in comparison. And so the scale of the challenge perhaps that we're trying to solve is comparable. The impact is far greater on humanity. And the urgency is far greater, but the level of government support and generally investment is actually on the smaller side when you might compare it to other industries that are certainly comparable. So there's positive tailwind, but I think a lot more could be done.
And actually, we're going to start wrapping this up, but what do you think is the the most common pattern that these companies are, that lab-grown companies are going to exit to? Do you think that it's going to be, most of them will go into the public market? Do you think that most of them will be acquired by these large incumbents? Like, or how do you view the future of the lab-grown meat industry?
I think now we've seen an evolution of the types of company that are getting created. Very early on, the first generation companies were incredibly vertically integrated. They had no partners, as like Malthus, for example, to help them in technological development in areas like growth media. That means they've spent tens of millions and several years developing the core technology before they can even, you know, think about and transition from being an R&D company into a more public-facing and commercial product-oriented company. That has meant that a lot of technology has been internalized. And I think there are companies now that perhaps are very strong core technologies, but are looking outwards towards bolstering that with enabling technologies. And so perhaps I can see some of those enabling technologies or core technologies being acquired and added to a portfolio of technologies that can increase product value and product range. I think some of these first generation companies will probably look towards the public markets and go public with products that they'll bring to market in the next couple of years. There are investments from large food companies, from the meat companies, which I can see as soon as this technology gets to a certain level of maturity, that will be acquired, and companies will look to be acquired to exit. And then equally, I think there are probably a few kind of startups now where with the right kind of perhaps private equity group could acquire a few companies and bring together enabling technologies to create a pretty competitive solution. And you're seeing that with some of the funds that have been set up that look like they're, you know, bringing together a broad portfolio of technologies that could at some point be very complementary.
But do you think that when these large meat manufacturers, when they really transition to the lab-grown production, do you think that it will be achieved through the acquisition of these companies that are highly specialized and have them from, you know, their DNA and their root is that? Or do you think that they will grow these capabilities internally and they might take longer to reach the same level of maturity and sophistication that maybe a company like Malthus has? But what do you think, how do you think this capability is going to transition, is going to like this distribute within the industry?
Well, I think we're certainly democratizing the technology around growth media, and there's a build versus buy decision that every company has to make. I think at a certain point, there's perhaps realization that with limited resources and time, you need to focus. And not every company should be trying to solve every technical challenge that is required to be solved to make these products a reality. And companies can certainly spend less money, move quicker, and get better results by working with specialists and partnering. We see this across many other industries where this is the way to create core value and to bring products to market quickly and focus on areas of true competitive advantage and differentiation. And certainly if you're a consumer-facing brand, the mass markets don't care about how fancy your technology is. They care about if you have a good product and a brand to get behind. So I think we're definitely seeing that companies that are partnering smartly are moving quicker. And even at the corporate level, there are strong partnerships that are being forged now and put into place as these products are coming to market.
Super interesting, Kai. I think we need to wrap this up, but last two questions that we usually ask to our guests. Can you recommend us a book or any kind of content? It can be startup related or not, although it usually is. And also suggest someone to invite to the podcast that hasn't been on before.
For sure. Yeah. So this is maybe a little bit mainstream, but it came to mind since I'm introducing a new concept here, cultivated meat, which is perhaps getting bigger than people might realize. So the All In podcast, which I'm sure many people listen to anyway, but a couple of episodes ago, they talked about lab-grown meat. And just to show that some of the opportunities in lab-grown meat to make large benefits to human and planetary health. And some of the interesting points brought up there around, you know, steak tastes different depending on where you grow it. There's actually a far greater opportunity in lab-grown meat to control taste and nutrition, because that really boils down to the genetics of the cells and how you grow them, what you feed them, and the environment in which you grow them. With animals, that takes several years of breeding, and you really can't control very finely the environment in which they're growing. But with cultivated meat, you can. And so you can create products that are incredibly tasty and incredibly nutritious, and think beyond the definition, the current definition of meat, by being able to create and design food in new ways. So I think they talked about it, and it's nice to see that going a little bit mainstream. And then just
I think on it wasn't in an episode a couple of weeks ago, I think, right?
Something like that. Right. Yeah, I think 2 or 3 weeks ago. Yeah, maybe I can get the number exact number for you. And then just
yeah, we'll find it out. Don't worry.
Somebody else to bring to the podcast. I would recommend a fellow UK company. I think doing great things over in Bristol. Will Milligan from Extracellular. They're building manufacturing capacity. So this is again. Biomanufacturing capacity is critical to scaling these new industries and technologies and bringing cultivated meat products to market. Will is working on contract development and manufacturing processes to help companies go from lab scale to pilot and commercial scale. So I'll plug Will.
We'll ask for an intro, that's for sure.
For sure.
Kai, thanks a ton. I think this was super interesting. As we said at the beginning, I mean, this is not the type of topic that we usually cover, but it's probably something that we need to pay more attention to. And it's actually, and thanks again to Isabel for bringing it up, because she's the expert one of the team. So thanks a ton for your time, Kai.
Thank you very much. This has been very fun, and looking forward to catching up again.